Okay, so welcome everyone to the 9/11 and Other Deep State Crimes teleconference for February 26, 2020. First, I want to thank Craig for handling the call last month by himself. I appreciate that. I was traveling. And Craig, do you want to take the role?
Sure. We'll read what I have on my screen here. I have Ann Hendricks, Barry Zwicker, Cheryl Curtis, Craig McKee, Dan Hennen, Fern Tishman, Gerald Pechenuk. Did I get the pronunciation right, Gerald?
You sure did. You sure did.
Okay. I think that's because I got it wrong one other time. James Hufford, Jonathan Mark, Carl Golovin, Marty Hopper, Mike Cook, Peter Ketchum, Steve Stadola, and Xander Arena. Did I miss anybody? Great.
Okay, great.
We're good there.
We're good there. Okay, great. So are there any objections to the minutes for the January 29th, 2020 conference call? Now, hearing none, then they're approved. And let's move on to the agenda for tonight. We have a slight change that wasn't on the agenda that got sent out. So what it's going to be is we have Jonathan on discussing the 20th anniversary. Barbara Honegger and Dave Meiswinkel will be on talking about the Lawyers Committee update. Frank Telepko will be joining us later in the call to do a 5 minute on, I forget what he's doing it on now. What is he doing
Who killed
on?
Malcolm X.
Oh, yes, that's right, Malcolm X, right. Malcolm X. And then we have Gerald Pechenuk going to be speaking for 5 minutes on Bill Binney. Are there any objections to these slight changes in the agenda?
What was the last one?
Gerald Pechenuk? Pechenuk speaking about Bill Binney.
Bill Binney, okay.
Okay, you got a speaking engagement in New York and anything related to that. So, okay, any objections to the slight changes in the agenda? Great, hearing none, then we'll proceed as it is. Okay, so let's begin with our first speaker, which is Jonathan Mark, and Jonathan's going to be talking to us about the 20th anniversary events, possible things we could do. And to introduce him tonight is Ann Hendricks. So, Ann?
Hi. Jonathan Mark publishes flybynews.com, and that came out of a campaign to expose or stop NASA's Cassini Earth flyby, a spaceship with 72 pounds of plutonium on board. It wasn't only the plutonium that was a concern, but the U.S. plans for weaponizing space. Jonathan also produced a film in 2012 called Dark Legacy, regarding JFK to 9/11. Thank you, Jonathan, for speaking tonight.
Yes, thank you very much, and thanks for everyone being here. This is a conference that, you know, started so many years ago, and in a way it's helped all of us at least, you know, find out that we're not the only ones that see this crazy elephant in the living room with buildings coming down at full speed, straight down, and knowing that, you know, no one's giving the answers to the unanswered questions, and how especially the peace movement has been in denial of this false flag operation that we know about, but many other people have this element of cognitive dissonance, which we learned from the psychologist doing such good work on, you know, explaining what comes up with the worldview of ours regarding 9/11 and the challenges for everyone, you know, and we all had to go through a lot. Now, my idea is to, you know, do something with this information, and anniversaries are always very helpful to unite things around a time period. And you know that the mainstream media is going to do their usual BS information, but I'm wondering if there would be communities wanting to have forums on that day and bring together peace activists and 9/11 truth researchers, perhaps even watching the 45-minute summary of Massimo's film, September 11th, The New Pearl Harbor, to finally discuss, you know, what is used as justification for the longest war in U.S. history and why the peace movement needs to confront that day and question why it hasn't in such a long time. But if by not confronting these things, you know, we end up with extreme political people like Trump, that is a what I consider a narcissist and corrupt to the core, and is a showman. And so many people are so pissed off at the Democrats and the usual games that both parties play. They just wanted somebody that, you know, was going to change something up. So now there's a Bernie Sanders campaign that has that same element of, as a populist, but it's attracting a whole different type of person, which really would like to see democracy protect the Constitution rather than disenable it for fascist dictatorship-loving regimes, which you know, our country has become. And in our film, Dark Legacy, JFK 9/11, it shows the progression. Actually, that came out of Operation Paperclip right after World War II to recruit you know, intelligence into what's called a shadow government, which utilized the different agencies like the CIA and others to assassinate the president and cover it up successfully, control the media to make conspiracy a bad word because they said it's a lone gunman. And they keep on doing these foreign policy situations, no matter who is in office, Democrat or Republican. They maintain their agenda. And now you get to see with this campaign, you know, the media and the billionaires and the corporate interests are freaking out because there's a populist that can actually overturn the pseudo-democracy that we've been having and the plutocracy into a possible democracy where there could be a majority of people saying we want someone that's going to be better at representing us as people and the planet, and that there's a reality to climate disruption by all these centuries of emissions that really do have an impact, and there's too much science in that to disregard. Though a lot of 9/11 researchers were planted into our communities to mislead us into a denial of the effects of since the Industrial Revolution of the fossil fuel burning into the atmosphere, and there's many other type of destructive elements coming into the atmosphere. So there's no question about it. But there is measurements going back 3 million years showing that we've surpassed carbon dioxide concentration levels for 15 parts per million. And this is raising up the youth. So you normally wouldn't have someone that is a democratic socialist being given such favor by mainstream America, but it's really the youth seeing the importance of dealing with the issue and perhaps getting their families involved, and with the diversity happening. And the blue-collar people just really fed up with the corruption of taking care of the elites rather than the rest of us. You know, people realize that, yeah, we can have programs if we close the divide of the super wealthy and the rich rest of us. So I bring all this up because 9/11 2021 is a year from this coming 9/11. A year from that. So this is like a brainstorming time where I'm looking at the 20th anniversary, and it falls on a Saturday, maybe around 9 a.m. We should have events because that was the time on that Tuesday of that event. And but it could be on the anniversary day of Saturday, September 11th. And you really need to start sooner than later, because the summer has a way of sneaking September 11th right onto us, and we really haven't utilized our movement to unite and have an impact on 9/11 truth as much as we could if there was more united elements. And I figure the 20th anniversary, if we can get groups like 9/11 Consensus giving us the you know, the itinerary of what we all agree about, you know, what's the consensus of, you know, of the critical evidence, and utilize a peace movement with 9/11 researchers and showing like films or discussions or a vigil, but just have a community, you know, reach out to their community with the press and other things, saying that we don't buy it anymore, and this has led us for 20 years into a disgraceful situation. And so you can't compete with this election year, but we can utilize this time to unite with peace activists. So I've written a letter to Trap Rock Peace Center in my area near Greenfield, Massachusetts, and the guy that was responding to the Facebook page said that he's going to bring it up to the next board meeting, and that a lot of them knew that 9/11 was an inside job right from the very beginning. But again, no one would talk about it, you know, or unite or organize about it. And so I'm just reaching out to them. I'm going to have to do a lot more because there is so much resistance, but there is time to unite with them within this democratic election. If we do have democracy, it's still possible, and we have a long ways to go to reclaim a lost republic with the truth really needing to come out. But there is something to elections. In 2000, when Fly By News was reporting the theft of the election with Gore and Bush, and having a Supreme Court choose a president, even though there was majority votes in Florida that gave the other person the election, my idea is that they only did that and stole the election because they wanted to do 9/11 in 2001. And there was a direct correlation with having a Bush Jr. in office and giving cover for 9/11, just like Obama was placed into position to give cover for Trump. I mean, for Bush and the bankers and the torturers. And he committed these unconstitutional actions of droning other countries with this kill list. So, that's what created Trump in so many ways, is the corruption of both of them. So since we have somebody that's willing to confront the oligarchs and put real plans out to make a difference, I think that's a good body to approach these peace groups to then get them to join us after the election to do something on 9/11 2021. I think I'm almost 20 minutes in. I'd like to get the discussion and any brainstorming ideas that you have for the 20th anniversary and your thoughts about if we can unite people on this. But I appreciate people listening and sharing their thoughts.
And Jonathan, you have a few more minutes if you want them.
Well,
done,
I'd like
fine.
To expand the discussion if it'll go that farther.
Okay, let me put it in Q&A. So if you'd like to ask a question, please star 6, and you'll get in the queue. And Jonathan, while we're waiting for them, with Operation Paperclip, that was when we took the scientists and stuff from Nazi Germany. Was that it, or might have the wrong one? Oh, you're muted. Hang on, Jonathan. I'll unmute you just a second.
Yeah,
Jonathan, did you hear my question?
Yes, I did. It wasn't just the scientists, but it's also the intelligence agents and commandos like Scorzani. And I got new information about the Italian Secret Service involved with the Kennedy assassination as well. And it was like a global plot, really, backed by these financiers that came and did that. But Operation Paperclip was the a way of getting the shadow government really dark, and with the claims of the Cold War being the reason for it. And so Wernher von Braun was with NASA with his rockets, and it became a mess. So
I'm reading a book now about gold warriors, and in it they said we did the same thing with the Japanese after World War II. We moved their scientists and families over to Fort Detrick, Maryland, to work on bioweapons programs and things. So I never knew that, so that's very interesting. Okay, thank you. We have some people in line here. Okay, Xander, you're there. You're next. Go ahead.
Hey, Jonathan. Xander here.
Hi, Xander.
Hey, buddy. I had a curiosity. Have you been following the Artemis program and the Artemis launch and NASA's press releases and discussions about that?
No. Give me a little update on it.
Basically, it's the goal is to land on the moon, but they seem to be dropping tons of Easter eggs regarding their actual intention to actually get there. and the fact that we didn't last time. I mean, it's really fun to watch the press releases. They talk about things like problems in past suits, such as zippers and all kinds of other stuff. So anyways, it's interesting, man. I just thought you might want to pay attention to it. And I know it's a little off topic, so I don't want to deviate too much.
Yeah, after, you know, I did a lot with the 50th anniversary of the moon landing hoax in 2019, and I was somewhat hoping that there'd be more of an awakening, but we did have a lot more people awaken to that, what we call a military psychological operation. But they've been promising the going back to the moon since 72, and ever since 72, no one's even gone beyond low Earth orbit. And when they tried in 98, they only got to 350 miles and were forced back because of the intense radiation. And the military
right.
that did the tests of the radiation field keeps that information classified as national security interest. So there is a takeover of truth in space on the great levels, and that's why I kind of got involved with 9/11, because in trying to stop weapons from entering space, it was because of 9/11 that gave them the excuse to start putting weapons in space and get rid of the ABM treaty. So
Jonathan, what I see when I look at the Artemis stuff is I see a bit of what seems to be an awakening now in the scientific culture of NASA, and also because of their partnership with private firms like SpaceX and whatnot. This could be a good thing for our truth movement on so many different aspects of, you know.
I sure hope so. I mean, there has to be a scientist with integrity that you know, can only take it so much.
Right.
And the
That was my comment.
Excuse me?
Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt. That's my comment. That's all I had.
Okay. And Bart Jordan, that you know, contacted me in 1999 because of the plutonium flyby of Earth. You know, he was involved with the NASA mission, and he would like to NASA to admit the moon landing hoax and do more robotic missions back to the Cydonia region, where he says there's monuments warning us about nukes. And there's been another investigator that found material from nuclear weapons on Mars. And then there's this information from these ancient civilizations that were able to pass it through ice ages, through language and artifacts. So it could be a good thing if we ever have truth in our world. We would then, you know, have a more of a humility and not be controlled by the military. And I don't know if you heard about the Ray McGovern. He kind of expanded on the military-industrial complex to Mickey Matt. Military, industrial, congressional, intelligence, media, academia, think tank complex, and they're all involved. And it's amazing how well they work together. But you know, they're controlled by the money interests, and it's a top down thing. And they're ruthless. And you know, we don't know if Bernie is going to survive this election if he continues to, you know, be independent. And he seems like he's ready to be, like, you know, this is like his life calling. and he's been trying to do this forever. And hopefully, you know, he won't get knocked off and there will be real big changes come about. But whoever is president, they need to hear us about 9/11, because no one's going to want to deal with it. They're going to have to be forced to. And the more we have forums and media coming out at that time, the better, you know, the situation will be for someone calling for and supporting the you know, New York legal work to do a new inquiry on it. And so I'm glad that we're all still here and we're still working at it.
Okay. And before the next question, I just want to ask, Craig, would you call Dave Meiswinkel? Or have you done that already? And you're on... Okay, so I guess Craig is doing that. Okay, great. Next, Gerald, you're up next. Go ahead.
Okay, here's a question for Jonathan, which I just say make one statement and then ask the question. As you know, Jonathan, Bill Binney, who was at the NSA right before 9/11 and insisted that 9/11 could have been prevented, and then he resigned, he and a number of others, and have spoken up vociferously about the explosion of surveillance. And the question that came up recently with Binney in the last couple of years is, Russia did not hack the DNC computers. So all this stuff, which I'm sure you saw the debate last night, we now have another Russian agent, Bernie Sanders, being pushed by the Russians. So unless we bust these lies about Russia, 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 what is your thought about getting more of the peace movement and the progressives and the liberals speaking up about these lies? Because at the debate last night, it seemed to me every one of those candidates was, I hate Russia. No, I hate Russia more than you hate Russia. Hey, I hate China too. I hate China more than you hate China. I hate China and I hate Russia. And so it seems to me it's important that we bust these lies of the media about Russia, hack the DNC. And so the peace movement, I think what you said is totally right. The peace movement should be out there speaking up. And I really would like to see your thoughts about getting more people actively busting these lies about Russia, 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 because they are definitely trying to tar Bernie Sanders with that same brush. That's my comment and question to you.
Yeah, they need to have an enemy to justify their budgets, and so it's all a game to them. But John Stockton mentioned that a CIA analyst from that went public finally. Kennedy used to be, you know, anti-Russia and a cold warrior. But then he learned after the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he was planning to make peace with Khrushchev to end the abolish the weapons of mass destruction and actually go to the moon with the Russians in a cooperative fashion. And then he was murdered, and you know, in the middle of the day, and there was no internet then, and they had control of people, and they actually gagged orders. Doctors in different hospitals that they couldn't talk about, or they lose their jobs. And the doctors on the first day of the examinations said one thing, then the second day they would change their stories, and so they created this lone gunman. And with Sanders, it's a, you know, a similar aspect. But if he does get to the position that Kennedy was in, I'm very hopeful that he would communicate to Putin directly and make plans for a peace direction rather than, because it's not, because he won't, you know, Bernie can't be effective or successful unless there is peace, because you need that those funds and divert it to dealing with the crisis of the, you know, replacing fossil fuel technologies and creating health care and get rid of the college debt. I mean, all these things are going to come from somewhere. And it's going to come from the super wealthy, and for converting the military-industrial complex to a more of a reasonable situation where each country only takes care of their own internal issues and stop this, you know, weapons of mass destruction. And so there is a chance that U.S. and Russia could be very responsible in helping all the nuclear nations abolish in a verifiable fashion, all weapons of mass destruction, and then make an agreement with each other to protect the world in a positive conventional force, rather than you know, having such weapons and technologies, you know, threatening all of life. But that would be a major change, and it's going to take steps. So that's why I like your idea with. You know, the exposure of the truth about the Russiagate, because you can't have as much interference as you have from the U.S. and from Israel than you would have from Russia or anywhere else. I mean, that's where you have Netanyahu actually speak to the Congress, you know, and they politicize everything. So it's kind of ridiculous, that focus, and I agree with you. And Bernie is just trying to just say that he's not into authoritarian regimes, that for Russia, the people would like to have a more of a democratic system and more transparency and freedom. And maybe there could be a give and take with Russia to you know, understand why they're in this situation where they're a totalitarian regime, because they're freaked out of the United States. And the United States looks like a democracy, but it's really a pseudo-democracy in the military force that has cause more problems in the world than anybody else. And that's just the reality. So Bernie could be a good step to, taking a look at things. I really do think he has a good chance at this point, and we'll know by Super Tuesday if he can actually win without the brokered convention. But it'll take the people really rising up, which would give us a lot more energy for 9/11 Truth in 2021.
Okay. Thanks for that, and thank you, Gerald. And next we have Barbara Honaker. Barbara, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, it's Barb. I came on about 10 minutes late. Apologies. Okay. So this is a number of things I want to respond. I think the main thing we were going to talk about was supposed to be the anniversary planning. And I think we should probably get back and focus on that before we do the Lawyers Committee update with myself and Dave Meiswinkle, who may have just come on. I wanted to point out something about Bernie Sanders. I support Bernie Sanders. I ran as a Bernie Sanders independent here in 2016 in Monterey County. I did very well. Didn't win because it's a Democratic, 75% Democratic voting Central California District 20. And I was running against Leon Panetta's son, James Jimmy Panetta, who won. But anyway, I'm a strong Bernie supporter and ran as a Bernie Sanders independent in 2016. I want you to know something that really shocked me that I heard on MSNBC, which is supposed to be a progressive station but isn't really. It's just another part of the establishment media. Brian Williams, who is their anchor, their top anchor, comes on at 8 o'clock and 11 p.m. every night, Monday through Friday. About a week ago, after Bernie did really well, after he won Nevada, they were having their pundit around a table, and Brian Williams was leading the pundit on the panel. And I don't remember, frankly, what question or comment by one of the pundits or commentators it was in response to. But what he said was that they were expressing anxiety about Bernie Sanders being a self-proclaimed Democratic socialist, and wouldn't Trump love it, and the Democrats would be smeared in the election, which I don't agree with. But Brian Williams apparently agreed with that assessment, and he made a comment that put chills up and down my spine. He really is a top spokesman for the American mainstream television media, and he said, "Well, they may not be able to stop him, but they can kill him." That's what he said.
Yeah, he said it on the air, huh?
Said it on the air.
Yeah.
And he didn't say that's a joke, folks, or anything like that. He just went on to his next comment. And it gave me chills because something similar to that was said just before by a mainstream television commentator just before Kennedy was killed in Dallas. While the live television coverage was ongoing of Kennedy's arrival in Dallas. So it reminded me of that. So that's number one. Number two, I think Jonathan Mark mentioned Scorzeny, very important. I may have mentioned it before on these calls. Everybody needs to get the Scorzeny Papers. It's a book, and it's S-K-O-R-Z-E-N-Y. Scorzeny was Hitler's top commando assassin, head of special operations throughout World War II. And the Scorzeny Papers is based upon Scorzeny's own papers that he bought. He was a successful bidder in an auction about 4 or 5 years ago. He read those papers, fell off of his chair, and wrote the book about them. And the bottom line is the Scorzeny Papers, that are Scorzeny's secret diaries and papers, show that Scorzeny activated. This is Hitler's head of special operations now throughout World War II. He was brought 2 years after the end of World War II from a POW camp in Camp King into working with the Allies to train up to 1,000 assassin special operations, special ops covert operators and assassins for all of the World War II Allies, United States, France, Britain, and, interestingly, the new state of Israel. He trained the Mossad assassin. Now, that's very interesting, the head of Hitler's special operations. So you've got to read this, and the bottom line is in the Scorzeny papers that the papers show that Alan Dulles, who had, of course, been fired as head of the CIA by Kennedy, that Alan Dulles got to Skorzeny and activated Skorzeny to in turn activate the French shooter Sautre, who was one of the shooters at Ely Closet. So that's the Skorzeny papers. You really have to read this. It's mind-blowing. There was something else that Jonathan said that I want to add something important to, and I will send Craig and Cheryl the link to my presentation at the JFK conference this past anniversary of the JFK assassination in Dallas. I gave this presentation together. It was a panel, basically, but we were each at the podium with Judith Berry Baker, who was Lee Harvey Oswald's girlfriend, and the two of us did that panel. But for part of my time, I called up a woman by the name of Chana Willis, W-I-L-L-I-S-B-H-A-N-A, and you will see for yourself. I'll give you the time into that video, to that YouTube, and that you will see that Chana Willis's father was part of the, you might call it the advance team for the assassination of Kennedy. He was there for two, before and a little bit after the assassination of Kennedy. And he makes it, he was the deep state and the military's top photographer for the then highly classified, top secret, above top secret U-2 spy missions and the Corona satellite system that was spying on Soviet missiles, including over Cuba for the Cuban Missile Crisis. And she goes on record there at the podium that, and she had all of her father's photographs in a binder there and his documents, many of them still classified. And she's very courageous to do this. And she said that her father told her that before the Cuban Missile Crisis, as early as 1960-61, that the United States military, led by the Navy at that time, had, and presumably still does, but had back then a system of military satellites with laser weapons that point down that were designed to try to take out missiles in there before they would reach their target. But they were already up there at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. So that's number three. I want to just point out to people that you really need, if nobody has it, I can send it to Cheryl and Craig if you want to post it for the minute. Assange is, yesterday was day two of his extradition hearings in London, and they are shocking. They're absolutely shocking. It's clear that the British magistrate is acting as if she were the prosecuting attorney. It is shocking what she says. The next is the claim that Bill Binney said Russia didn't hack the DNC. That's actually not what he said. What he said, and it's a fact because of his expertise, what he actually has demonstrated is that the download speed was way too fast for there to have been a distant hack from Russia over the Internet. However, that doesn't mean that a Russian agent couldn't have been next door and did it, you know, 10 feet away or 50 feet away or anybody else. So it is actually an inference of Bill Binney, not a claimed fact, that Russia did not hack the DNC computers before the 2016 election. And I just like to point out to people, if you don't have it already, I can send it. But a very high-level expert also in the NSA, Thomas Drake, disagrees with Bill Binney's analysis. So just so you know that. And then I hope that we go back and talk about the anniversaries coming up. I will let you know that I was on the Europe 9/11 group call yesterday. It happens once a month, the last Tuesday of the month. And we made a decision for the European group, of which I'm a member, even though anybody in the U.S. can be part of that group. You can call in if you want. We made a decision. We voted to hold this anniversary, this September 11th, which is a Friday. We are going to hold an event in The Hague in Belgium, which is the headquarters of the International Criminal Court and all of those high-level EU government headquarters. So that's going to be very exciting. And the main purpose of it is to have the lawyers committee have representatives there to update everybody on the legal actions that are happening in the United States, and hopefully we'll have some positive outcome. So that kind of leads into Dave Meiswinkle and my update on the lawyers committee, but that's
you it. Hang on a minute, Barbara, for that though, okay? Jonathan, did you want to say anything in response to Barbara?
Yeah. The 9/11 20th anniversary community forums is an events page on Facebook that I put up there, and I'm hoping other people with other events will sign up there and co-host events. And my idea, because not everyone can really travel or we can afford it, to have your own forum in your neighborhood on that, the 2021 9/11 to do something local and then just do the press releases and everything, and then we'd all be together. Maybe this coming 9/11 we could do a special teleconference and finalize the plans, maybe with some peace activists. But it'd be nice if there's a little time at the end of as it gets closer for this teleconference for us to plan on ideas of what would work in your community and what you're planning on doing, and that if you could sign up on that Facebook page, that'd be.
And what is? Forgive me, I couldn't hear you. What is the Facebook page again?
It says 9/11 20th anniversary.
So 91120 then TH.
Yeah, 9-11 20th anniversary, and then dash community forums.
Okay. That's for the 20th. That's not for this year's.
Right. So this year, I would like to have some special events and teleconferencing, but again, I'm like a local person now. I'm not doing a lot of traveling, partly because of carbon footprint, but also finances, and we can communicate so well right now, not being where we are. And bringing things locally is will afford it to more people, I think, overall.
Okay. All right, very good. And I just would like to propose, whether it's this year or for the 19th anniversary or the 20th, when we hold these events, I think, Jonathan, you said somewhere around 9 a.m. in the morning, I think we should hold these events at 9:11 in the morning, wherever we are. And also, when I put on, as you probably know, I think everybody has the link to all the videos from the big Zurich conference that I produced and organized in Zurich, Switzerland. It was the big Europe conference this past anniversary, on September 11th, 2019. And we charged what do they call their money? I forget. But anyway, francs, I think. It was the charge at the door was 9.11 Swiss francs. And people really liked that. They really liked having an event at 9:11 in the morning as well. So that's one way that we can even go around with all the different time zones. There are going to be different physical times, but that's kind of, we have to live with that. But if people hold everything at 9:11 in the morning, that's a peg that the media can grab onto. It's very clever.
And if you can help me get in touch with other 9/11 organizations like 9/11 Consensus Group and others, we need to get them on board to give this more visibility. And so architects and engineers, if we can do something together, not just in our separate groups, but do something that is symbolic of our unity, it would have more power.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, just to remind everybody, for a number of years now, the Lawyers Committee and Architects and Engineers have not only held our events together with our speakers together at all of the major anniversaries and major events, even not on anniversaries, but we're actually partners. We've partnered in joint fundraisers. I really like the idea of reaching out to Elizabeth Woodward for this coming anniversary and the next one, kind of get the bugs out on the 19th anniversary in preparation for the 20th, and really bring in the Consensus Project as part of our event.
Thank you, Barbara.
Okay, yeah. And Jonathan, before we wrap up, I just also had some thoughts on that. What if, just as a suggestion or a brainstorming here, what if you set up a monthly teleconference just for that planning that and reached out to all different 9/11 groups, and then reached out to not only the anti-war community, but why not the Muslim community, maybe civil liberties groups, alternative media groups, you know, people focusing on the lies of the media, different things like that, to make it really big, you know, all the consequences of 9/11 affect all these people. So just a thought on that.
That's a great idea.
Good idea. Yeah.
I hope you do it. if I can help, I will.
Well, somebody should do it anyway. All right. Okay, great. Thank you. And that now brings us to, I'm going to put us in and then let's see, we'll unmute Barbara and Dave. And Dave, okay.
I think Dave, okay. Is Dave on?
Yeah, I just unmuted him, but let me see. I think he might have. Okay, he's unmuted now. Okay, so great. And Barbara and Dave are going to update us on what the Lawyers Committee is doing, what the court is doing in response. And I don't think they need an introduction. So thank you, Dave and Barbara, for doing this. And take it away.
Dave, sir.
Thank you for having us on. I would say, as we probably all said it before, history is in the balance here. Right in New York City with this grand jury petition, what's happening there, you can just imagine if those documents and statements that are dispositive controlled demolition were ever shown to grand jury, we'd have a different writing of history right there, all right, because they would drop people's mouths right away and they would start to investigate it properly. But anyway, give you a background on the situation was back in April of 2018, we put the grand jury petition together and we went down to the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York City in Folly Square area and presented it at the building. And then we, in July, we amended it to include extra explosive counts. And we waited, and in November of 2018, we were pleasantly surprised by a letter from Jeffrey Berman, the U.S. attorney, and in that letter he said he received, reviewed, and would comply with the statute. The statute was 18 U.S.C. 3332 and A, and that has to do with his requirement to submit the evidence to a grand jury and tell the grand jurors who gave it to him. Now, a grand jury, when they convene, they can indict, it needs 16 to 23 people. And those people are chosen through usually something like a voter registration list or something objective like that. So anyway, they admitted, or they told us that they received it and were reviewing it, and we waited patiently. And then last July, we gave them a call, and we spoke to Michael Ferreira, who is the head of counterterrorism. He's the assistant U.S. attorney. And we asked them if he could give us any kind of indication that they were acting in good faith in proceeding. And he told us he could not under Rule 6 of the federal laws, federal statutes, which require secrecy having to do with grand juries. Now, we don't believe that's totally true because there's things called ministerial records, which don't tell you basically what the content of the grand jury is, or any kind of testimony or witnesses or anything like that, but could give you a hint as to whether something's being called or a meeting or an agenda or something like that. They could provide that type of information. But they decided not to give us any kind of information. So we had told them at the time that if something's not forthcoming, we would be required then to go into court and with a petition, a mandamus petition, to sue them, basically. And we waited and waited. And then last September 6th, we filed, and then we served them at the beginning of December. And they responded with a letter to the court telling the court that they were going to file a motion to dismiss. And we then were instructed to do the same, to respond to that in the letter, which was done. And the judge now has set up a briefing schedule because they have to have their papers in by, I believe, around March the 3rd, which is coming up. So we will get to see what their arguments are. Thus far, they say we don't have standing. And the standing is basically to show that a harm was done you and that you are basically worthy or you have a right to make this this complaint or this request. So what we say this, of course, we do have standing, but what we will do, and we've told the judge to make it stronger, we have a right to an amendment. We can amend. You have one right to amend in the federal level. So we've told them that already, that if they try to dismiss this, then we will amend the complaint. So and what's happened now, the judge has given them 2 weeks to do this this motion to dismiss. We have 1 week to respond to it, but the judge already knows that we're going to file a new motion, and then they have 2 weeks to respond to our little brief. So what will happen probably was we would be back to square one again, and where they can, the filings will go on again. Now, they'll have the opportunity then to answer the complaint if they want to, okay? They can deny or affirm and respond to the complaint, or they can put that motion in to dismiss, which they probably will do again. The action we filed will be stronger now. At this time, the action was the Lawyers Committee and Richard Gage. We were the plaintiffs here, all right? The next time it will be, in addition, will be victims, family members, and maybe architects and engineers too. So that's what's going on in New York City. So it's kind of really interesting right now. As I said, there's a lot here that's in the balance, because as the judge gets into that, and if he reviews the complaint and takes it seriously, he's going to have some rough decisions, because to most people, if you review that complaint and look at the evidence, you're going to say, man, there's no question here. There's something very serious happened, and this should be investigated. This is what all we're asking, is that objective body of individuals look at the evidence and then decide what to do with it. Now, we had another lawsuit down in Washington, and it involved the mandamus too. And this was an interesting lawsuit. It was under the Administrative Procedures Act and also under the federal mandamus action. Now, what happened there is our action was dismissed completely. All right. Now, we're in the process of appealing, and I think those appeals have to be done. We have to have a brief, I think, or a notice of appeal by the 3rd of March also. Both of them, I think, are around the 3rd of March. Now, what that lawsuit did was it was seven counts. And the first count had to do with the controlled demolition evidence, which is in the New York City grand jury petition. All that evidence is 57 exhibits and 54 pages of petition, 57 exhibits. And that included things like the red-gray nanothermite paper by Niels Harrits and Stephen Jones, Kevin Ryan. That was number one exhibit. Number two exhibit was Dr. Rousseau's seismic reports indicating there was explosions in the basement prior to the plane hitting, and explosions in the basement prior to the buildings coming down. Very significant. And all the testimony of the firemen, et cetera. Richard Gage, Tony Zimbardi, Stephen Jones, Willie Rodriguez, a whole lot of, interesting videos and or statements or studies are all in there. Now, just to let you know that, just recently we made contact with an ex-FBI guy, and he was very impressed. He wasn't aware, really. He's an FBI, and he deals with explosives and stuff like that. And at one time, he's retired now, he's an attorney, and he just wasn't aware of what we're presenting. And I think it's really changing his life right now, which is good in the sense of how he's perceiving the crimes and redirecting his attention to them. And he's going to assist us in different ways. But what this complaint in Washington is very interesting, in addition to the evidence having to do with controlled demolition and explosives, that's the count that the architects and engineers joined us in. They didn't join us in on the remaining counts. There was other six counts. Bob McElvain did. So Bob McElvain is on this petition down there, or this lawsuit, and they include the dancing Israelis or the high fibers. That was this complaint was based on Congress set up a 9/11 review commission in the 2013-2014, and what their job was, they were tasked to for the FBI to assess any evidence that hadn't been originally considered by the original 9/11 commission. So we gave them seven areas of evidence that they didn't update the Congress on, which they had a mandate to do so. And that first one was the controlled demolition. The second one had to do with the dancing Israelis. The third one had to do with the destruction of photos, because I think we believe the FBI represented to us that they had destroyed those photos at around the time when the Congress was ordering them to do an assessment and then update them on what evidence that hadn't been considered originally. And then there's a fourth count on the Saudi financing. The fifth count was on the Pentagon cameras and photographs that nobody's ever seen, and cameras we didn't even know about. And the sixth count has to do with plane parts, and particularly serial numbers we would be interested in. And you all would probably know why we'd be interested in the serial numbers and the controversy over the planes and what plane hit the buildings, and if they in fact did, if it's something else other than those particular planes, and or that what crashed it or what happened at Shanksville. And then the count seven had to do with the cell phone communications and versus the air phone communications versus the FBI flip-flopping from one to the other. And his explanations don't make sense and or aren't really credible. Anyway, that's what that lawsuit was about. Now, what we have to do is we have to appeal it, and that's what we'll do. Now, the fact that you don't win in the first round, that's to be expected when you fight these guys. They're not going to go easy. They run the roost, and you might have to, you know, string it out and go and take it further, and which we will with these federal lawsuits. So that's the situation with both lawsuits. The government is doing what most of us could have predicted they would do, is they would try to get it dismissed on some technicality, saying you don't have standing, you don't have grounds to do it. Some other reasons could be maybe there's a statute of limitation eclipsed, but with regards to terrorism crimes and when you're dealing with this type of murder and things like that, this mayhem, there's no statute of limitation. So the standing is the main argument, and or that they don't have a requirement to do what we're asking them to do. All right, that means that they don't have a requirement, for example, in New York City, to present this evidence, and or down in Washington, they don't have a requirement to update Congress. That's their other part of their argument. So we're saying that no, they do have a requirement. Now, what a mandamus does in the New York City lawsuit, basically, it's a disclosure. We're asking them to disclose to us in some way whether the grand jury is going forward and that evidence has been presented, and you know, if they give us some indication and we're satisfied with it, it ends right there. We wait till the grand jury has done its work, which could be a long time. But if we don't get the disclosure, the judge decides you're not entitled to that, then the second part is where the mandamus kicks in. And what we ask the judge then is to order them to do what the statute says, and that means to give the evidence to the grand jury. So we ask the judge to order them to do their job, basically. And that's what we're doing down in Washington, D.C. We're asking the judge to order the FBI to do their job. Now, in Washington, D.C., they said, you know, they just threw it out, all right? And now, again, that doesn't mean it's not worthy of being considered. Of course it's worthy. We wouldn't bring it up there. It's just that we're dealing with a stacked deck, perhaps, right, at that level, and perhaps at all the levels. We'll find out. So no one, I don't think, has done this before. So we're in new waters, and we expect that there'll be obstacles everywhere we go. Now, there are some FOIA lawsuits we're doing, too. And, you know, one has to do with Column 79 of the Building 7. We're trying to get the blueprints, et cetera, like that. One has to do with witnesses that FEMA had interviewed, et cetera. And they're in different various stages. But what we want to do as we go forward is we have brought an investigator on staff with the Lawyers Committee. That's been very helpful. And we want to become more professional with investigators. Of course, we have to raise money to hire investigators to do the kind of work we want done. But recently I was down in Washington. I met with Bill Binney down there. I know Bill Binney. And I would differ from a little bit from what Barbara says about him. But I'm not going to go into that now. We haven't taken a position, the Lawyers Committee, on what Bill Binney says as far as the Russian hack or whatever. But Bill Binney is a really top-notch person, individual. In fact, for anyone who wants to hear him, he's going to be in New York City this weekend making a presentation on the police state. All right, so you can catch Bill Binney in New York. But anyway, he was down in Washington, D.C. I was invited to go to a Samuel Adams presentation, and that's a whistleblower presentation where you got a whistleblower, ex-CIA, Jeffrey Sterling, was awarded. And I met down there, besides Binney, was Ray McGovern, who I've known a little bit, and Colleen Rowley, who I talked to. Colleen actually was running it. Colleen Rowley's FBI former, you might know her, with Zachariah Massawi, a very nice woman, and she's an attorney also. And John Curacao, he made a CIA guy that was referenced to the torture, and Thomas Drake, I spoke with him briefly also. So these are some people, some of them may be helpful for our investigations, the veterans intelligence professionals for sanity, and that's VIPS. And so we didn't have that before to draw on. So we have now a professional investigator. We have some connections, I think good connections, to the VIPS people. And we have, through these people and others, we have now some connections to former FBI people that may be helpful for us. So that's all encouraging, you know, as we go forward. Now, one of the things that we want to do, hopefully we do, is we want to set these investigation committees up. And we have a number of possible grand juries that could be in session, just like the one we hope to bring about in New York City. And I, you know, you can guess them. I don't have to really tell you what the likelihood is, but I will. Shanksville is a possible. The Pentagon is possible. One is the anthrax is very possible and most likely. Another one is New Jersey. A lot of people don't know that New Jersey has a lot of connections to 9/11. I won't go into them, but if something happens to New York, it could be a good fallback in New Jersey, at least to try again. And then there's the government misconduct and obstruction. In every aspect, this crime should have never happened. And you can talk to Binney about that in Thin Thread. They had the program to prevent that from happening, and they had it ready to be operational. And Haig scrapped it. He took the aspects of the program that where you could survey people, but the good aspects to protect the citizens that were built into it, they wouldn't allow it to happen. And Binney says that they would have detected the 9/11 terrorists, alleged terrorists, before the event. But anyway, so that's pretty much what I'm saying is that's the grand jury petitions. Not the grand jury, yeah, the grand jury petitions we'd like to put into motion. In order to do that, they set up the investigation committees, and I know probably someone to call, maybe have called me or left me a note or something, they'd like to be on it. I will get back to you on that. Nothing's locked in yet as far as how it's going to be set up. We're looking for people that are very dedicated, that are serious, that are open-minded, that want to look at the evidence, to gather the evidence, and then to reach some conclusion based on all evidence gathered and considered. So that we don't know what the time scale would be. Some of the grand juries might be ready before others. Some of them will be easier. Something like the Pentagon might be very, very complicated and very, take a little time because there's so many different points of view on that. Others may be very short, simple, like the anthrax. Government misconduct seems like a real challenging one because everywhere you look is somewhere the government should have been doing something. For example, the interception, right? That should have never happened. Or testing for explosives in dust or something simple as that, right? So it would be the that obstruction grand jury would have to do with the complicity in allowing 9/11 crimes to happen and the failure to properly investigate after it happened. So you have like a duel there. If that could come off, that'd be pretty good, I think. But that's sort of where we stand now. One of the things I've said before that I'd like to do, and again, that's really up to our board, but a proposal that we will make is that we have a public page, basically for the public to, and it will be a disclaimer on there, basically saying something to the extent that the Lawyers Committee doesn't take any position on any of these, anything on this page, but we offer the page for our fellow citizens to present evidence that they think is important for the Lawyers Committee to consider in trying to help solve these crimes, help to put together a grand jury petition, so that we would get a lot of participation from the public, and maybe we'd have a commentary area too on it. It would have to be really regulated in the sense that we have to vet the people, or not vet people, but the evidence. We don't want crap to come through there. But, the evidence is attorneys, if I want to prove my case, I hire an expert, and the expert basically helps me prove my case, but my opposition hires an expert too, and his expert may say the exact opposite of my expert, and both of them are experts, right? But they're looking at the same evidence, but they're spinning it or interpreting in a different way. So that's what happens lots of times, and people don't have to be necessarily nefarious or anything to have different opinions, right? Everybody could look at something and see it in a little different way. But we don't want junk coming through there. So if we ever do set that page up, it would have to be, screened to the extent where this is reasonable. It's reasonable evidence that should be considered. So that's some of the things we're doing. Barbara's going to tell you about an activity we're going to be having coming up shortly out in the West Coast. And I'll be taking questions. If you have some questions for me, be glad to. And thanks for having us on.
All right. Thank you, David. Barbara, why don't you go ahead, and then we'll do the questions after you've both spoken.
Okay. Yeah, a couple of few comments on Dave's comment. If I understand, Dave can correct me, but I believe this is true from our board call. My understanding is that these motions to dismiss, both in the New York mandamus and the D.C. mandamus, that the essential argument is lack of standing. And so the bottom line is we only have Bob McElvain down in D.C., and we need to add him to our response up in New York, which we will be doing. But we really need other plaintiffs who are willing, who are family members, victims, family members, or survivors.
Barbara, that's right. And what one of our guys is doing, John O'Kelly, he knows his brother's a fire chief in New York. And he's looking, trying to outreach to some firemen that he knows, whether they'll, put their name on something now, 19 years later. That's going to be interesting. Okay, so that is actually going on with Barbara's tongue. We're looking for other people to want to join the suit. There is, besides Bob, he can be on this easily in New York City. And I think the question, too, that to realize that this suit and it's not just standing, it's also a mandatory duty. So there's two arguments, basically, they make, that we don't have standing. But how could someone say that Bob McElvain doesn't have standing in the FBI lawsuit down in Washington when he is one of the complainants, and his son was killed, and the judge is ruling, including count one, having to do with controlled demolition and bombs in the building. Now, Bob believes his son was exploded, basically. It was an explosion, and the explosion killed him as he's walking into the North Tower in the lobby area. So how can a judge do that? Well, he did it. A judge did that. Now, that doesn't mean on appeal, another judge won't scratch their head and say, boy, that's wrong. These things always get reversed, okay? So that's a possibility, and that would be down in Washington. But certainly up in New York City, we'll add Bob and others, you know, if we can add others. So like Barbara said, if you know people that have an injury, and it could be someone that actually has a disease now, maybe a first responder who has, you know, a problem, and or certainly a victim's family member that lost somebody, they would have standing, we believe, yes. Even though this judge might say don't, okay?
Right. So the bottom line is, if anybody, we need your help, is the basic message here. And we need your help quickly because we have a deadline, March 3rd. So if you know anyone who is a victim's family member, who is a first responder, who is ill from the dust, from the toxic dust, whatever, please contact Dave as quickly as you can. Well, and you, if you know them personally, contact them and ask them if they'd be interested. You don't have to say willing yet. Let Dave do the lobbying and the persuasion. But we do need your help because the more plaintiffs who have standing, who have clear standing, like Bob McElvain, the better. From a layman's point of view, I'm not an attorney, though I was a high-level Justice Department official and, you know, worked with attorneys every day, as I do on the Lawyers Committee. So I have an understanding of the law. But from an educated and informed layman's point of view, like most of us on this call, maybe everybody except for Dave, to me, basically what the judges in these cases are saying is it doesn't matter if the government lies to you. They're basically saying, you know, you haven't been harmed by the government. You haven't been harmed, Bob McElvain, by the government lying to you about your son, the cause of your son's death. That's what it amounts to me. But anyway, I just wanted to put out the call for your help. Don't think that the Lawyers Committee can do it all. We always need participatory help, and this is something very explicit. So now I'm going to let you know of an exciting event that's coming up that Dave and myself and also one of our big heroes in the 9/11 Truth Movement, New York Fire Commissioner Christopher Goya, I'm sure that most of you know about him, if not all of you. He came out last year with four other members of his ladder called the the New York Franklin Square and Munson Fire Commissioners. Fire Commission commissioners, all five of them signed a petition last year supporting the New York World Trade Center 1, 2, and 7 grand jury petition and evidentiary exhibits filed by our Lawyers Committee. And they also have their own petition. And Commissioner Goya and Dave and I are going to be at an event. Actually, Dave and I will physically be at the event, and Commissioner Goya will be monitoring it live by remote link, and then he will be brought in by remote link as well. And that's going to be live streamed. I'm going to send Cheryl and Craig the link to watch it live, and it will also be, which is on the Lawyers Committee YouTube channel page. I'm going to give you the direct link for that. I'll send that for the minute. And if the minutes could go out, Cheryl and Craig, a little bit at least before March 6th so that people know how, or actually what I will do also, I'll send that to you for the minute, but I'll also send an email to the whole list with the information and the flyer for the event attached with the live stream link. So it's going to be in San Diego. It's a Lawyers Committee event that is hosted and sponsored by the San Diego 9/11 Truth Group, which is one of the most active and best in the country, as you know. And it's going to be on Friday, March 6th, coming up in San Diego at the Mission Valley Library for anybody who's in that area. That's 2123 Spenton Parkway in San Diego. Starts at 2 o'clock, goes for 3 hours from 2 to 5. Dave will speak first, then me, and then Commissioner Goya, simply because he's working and with a time difference, he can't go sooner than that. And then we're going to open it up to Q's and A's. We're going to be discussing how maybe people could chat or email in Q's questions. I don't know if that's going to be possible or if it'll just be from the audience there. But you can watch the whole thing, and I will send the flyer. So this is really exciting. If anybody has any questions, let us know.
Okay, thank you, Barbara.
To follow up on that, if I can follow up for a second.
Yeah, go ahead.
The live stream is a first-time adventure for us. Our webmaster, Doug West, is he's promoting us. He's taking us to that level. And in part how he could do this, he created a YouTube channel there. So you can go on our YouTube. If you go on the Lawyers Committee, lc4911.org, and scroll down on the right side, you'll see like an icon for YouTube. You hit on that, you can go into about 220 YouTubes at least that are posted up there. And basically, they're fairly relevant to what we're discussing. And because he has the numbers up, I guess we can do this live stream. But we had at one time, a handful of YouTubes. Now we've got a little library there, which hopefully will be a big library someday. And again, too, as I said, reference to, bringing on staff of an investigator, a webmaster, and things of that nature. It does cost some money. So if you do know any money, and I'm going to ask you particularly the grassroots people, but maybe you know somebody that has some big dollars that could help out, and we could really use that to take us to the other level so it's not too hard to do it and get more investigators involved. We've seen the results of one investigator. You can't believe it. When they know their stuff, they are very good. They are very good. So if we could get three or four of them, my goodness, we could do miracles probably. All right, well, thanks a lot.
Okay, so let's go into lecture mode then. If you'd like to ask a question, it's star 6. And while we're waiting for them, let me just unmute you guys here. Let's see. Unmute Dave. Okay. Dave, you should be unmuted. And Barbara. Okay. And while we're waiting for people to sign up, I just had a question. It sounds like the judge in New York is maybe somewhat sympathetic, or did I understand that wrong? Or do you have a sense of the judge? And then I also wanted to mention Rudy Dent was a firefighter in New York, retired, and he's pretty outspoken about 9/11. I haven't heard from him in quite a while, but he might be interested in being part of your lawsuit. So just a suggestion.
Well, that's interesting. I know Rudy.
Okay.
I'm not sure if he used to live in New York State, but I think he might have moved out west. I think he may have.
Yeah,
moved
I think
out
he
west.
Moved to Phoenix or Arizona somewhere. Yeah.
I think you're right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, in reference to the judge, I wouldn't say the judge is favorable to us. I think what the judge realized, you have to realize, the judge gave them 2 weeks to do their brief, gave us 1 week, and then 2 weeks to them to follow up on ours. So they gave them 4 weeks and us one. That doesn't look that fair.
Okay.
Okay. But what he realized is that when the complaint was drawn up, and that was drawn up by Mick and John O'Kelly with, the board's review of it. But Mick and John O'Kelly, see, John O'Kelly is from New York, so he's right there in his home turf. But when it was drawn up, I forget what I was going to say. The point I wanted to make was in reference to the judge giving us he didn't give us the time. I mean, he expected this. What was made mention in that brief was that we were going to amend it, and we had a right to amend it. Now, lots of times you don't have a right to amend it, but right at the beginning of a case, you can amend it to include more plaintiffs. So the judge realizes that he's only given us a week because we've already said in a letter what we're going to do, and then we'll do it through a notice not a notice of motion, but through a brief, and then the opposition, whether they're going to need that much time to knock it out or not, they know that even if they try to knock it out, we have a right to bring it back in again. So it's sort of like we're doing this flurry, but it doesn't really mean anything right now, other than that probably we're going to get a second bite of the apple, which legally we're entitled to, and then we're going to start the process all over again. So they have to decide then whether they want to make a motion to dismiss it or to answer the complaint. See, if they answer the complaint, then that's a whole different scenario than if they try to get it dismissed. Right? Lots of times people answer complaints. You know, you say yes or no. And you go down, every complaint has like a paragraph, and you go through the paragraphs and you deny or affirm and things of that nature. Okay? So I wouldn't say the judge is friendly to us. I would just say he's being practical to himself. I'm not sure why he gave them so many weeks, though. That's kind of suspicious. That seems to be, to me, like he's more favoring them.
Yeah, it doesn't seem fair. Yeah. Yeah. And what's his name? Do you have, can you give that out?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't have his name right now.
Oh, okay. Okay. Okay, great. Well, we have a couple people in line here. Xander, you're up. Go ahead.
Hey, David, this is Xander. Hey, man, I'd really like to chat with you off the call, and I just sent you an email with my phone number. Would you be amenable to a brief chat after this conference call?
Yes, I would. I would. Uh-huh.
Okay, thanks, man, very much.
Right.
Okay, bye.
Okay, all right. Thank you, Xander. And then Ann Hendricks, you're next. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Ann Hendricks. I have an idea for the standing issue. Maybe you could counter them with the Constitution. If you bring in the First Amendment, it says that Congress shall make no law abridging the right of the people to petition the government for a redress of grievances.
Well, listen, I think that's a good point, Ann. I'll bring it up to the drafters, all right? I'll mention it to Mick. He's working on it right now, a draft. I'll mention that you pointed that out.
That's all.
Okay, thank you, Anne. Okay. And I just had one more question for you guys. I want you to know, does it help for people to call the courts or write them letters, or is it better that we say nothing and let you guys handle it?
Well, that's up to your conscience. We wouldn't orchestrate it. I mean, the Lawyers Committee wouldn't ask you to do that, but people have done it in the past, and that's really up to them. That's your constitutional right to do that. I mean, you have a right to grieve or to write or however you wanted to do that.
You find that would that be helpful? I guess that's my question. Would it be helpful or
I don't get think in the it, way? It's going to matter one way or another to them, unless it's like maybe thousands of letters.
Okay.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it's all political. I hate to say it. All right, there's the politics that are involved. The context in which we live, the times that we live in, the history of that court down there. Now, there has been rulings, though, in that court, the Southern District, that favor us, okay? And they're going to have problems about that because it's not the first time that somebody's tried to put a grand jury request similar to ours on different issues, none on 9/11. And they were denied, and eventually they prevailed, all right? They were persistent, and they prevailed because it is the constitutional right of the people to do this. I mean, to request, the grand jury be convened to review, consider this evidence. That's our right. All right. So.
Okay.
I don't know one way or another. I think it's really up to the individual. I don't see how it can hurt. I don't know how much it helps, but certainly I don't think it can hurt at all.
Oh, okay, thank you. Okay, and then, Barbara, did you want to say something? You were in the queue.
Yeah, I think I was, it's Barb. I think I was put on mute and shouldn't have been.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, great.
So I just wanted to make a comment. Let's see. Oh, yes, actually a question of Dave. Dave, is it the case, I assume it is, but could you answer the question, on these two mandamus cases in New York and D.C., when we go through the whole process, if we still get a no from that level of the court, is there appeal, and can we appeal eventually all the way to the Supreme Court, or is that it?
Yeah, no, certainly is appeal. You certainly would appeal it, and I think you could go all the way to the Supreme Court. I think so. I think this issue is that important. So that they might be doing us a favor in some weird way. You know, it's almost like civil rights legislation at one time. When it was at more a local level, you always got bad results. And eventually, maybe the Supreme Court, again, if they're not too jaded and too biased, would look at this. This is really, as they say, no-brainer, that this is good evidence. I had an FBI guy look at our complaint. I'm telling you, this guy was 30-some years in the FBI, and he's a lawyer himself. And he looked at the petition, and he says, you know, you don't need my help. It's really good. And I told him, a lot of it was thanks to architects and engineers. You know, they gathered a lot of that evidence and stuff like that. But I said, we will need your help on these other grand juries. All right, we don't have as much evidence, all right, for Shanklu or the Pentagon or government obstruction, et cetera, anthrax. But, it definitely will be appealed, Barbara. And as I said, it might work to our advantage in a sense to keep the issue alive and to show them that we're really fighting and take it to the higher level.
Okay, and I just had a comment on Ann Hendricks' comment or proposal, and that is, unfortunately, this is, again, from an educated layman's point of view, who's worked with attorneys for many years, but the problem with your proposal about the First Amendment is that it puts a limitation on Congress not to do or not to do something. Congress shall make no law. It doesn't apply to the court. I don't believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Cheryl, could I make a quick comment, Craig, here?
Absolutely.
Very quick. I just, David, I just wanted to, I don't know if I might have missed this in your remarks or not, but when you were talking about people that might have standing, did you consider the two the fire commissioners in Franklin Square and Munson who are dealing with illnesses from their exposure to Ground Zero?
No. No, that's a good point because those guys, a lot of them, my understanding, there's a volunteer fire department over there in Franklin Square, Munson, but they're also paid firemen, and sometimes they work the two jobs, right? So they have connections.
Right.
So I know a lot of them work through Commissioner Joyce, and we're pretty close to Commissioner Joyce, so I know that, you know, he worked over there along with his friends. And he's very upset because he had a really good friend that was a couple of good friends that were killed
right.
that day. But there are also some that have diseases. So I'm going to mention that to John O'Kelly because John is, he's one of our attorneys working on this case, and he's directly trying to locate firemen. So that's a great idea, Greg. It's not too late. I'll get in touch with him tonight. But I will just tell him to reach out. That's possible. Okay? Very good.
Yeah, I do. Let me throw this in. I do remember when I interviewed Chris Joya that he did mention that two of the five commissioners were sick. So yeah, that might lead somewhere.
Okay. Very good.
Well, yeah, I'd like to make a comment on that. It's a good idea. I think even a better idea, Dave. When the video that's on the web of the fire commissioners meeting where they announced the petition, in the audience were family members who were totally supportive, who actually one of their firefighter comrades had died. So they are family members of someone who has clearly been harmed.
Yeah.
I think that those family members would be plaintiffs if Commissioner Goya requested them to be.
Yeah, well, we have to do that, and we have to do it rather quickly if we're going to amend this. I'm not sure what the time restraints are, but good idea, Greg and Barbara. Good idea.
Okay, we have one more question here from Carl Golovin. Carl, go ahead.
Dave, hi, Carl Golovin.
Carl, how you doing? How's D.C.?
it's well, actually, I have a side comment on that. At the Brookings Institution, the president, General John Allen, spoke with him after an event the other day. He was very cordial, and we spoke about false flag terrorism, evidence of it, even in leading up to conflict with Iran. And I gave him Richard Gage's contact information. Richard is sending him a copy of the university study, which he seemed very interested in receiving. It will be remarkable to get Richard and Professor Halsey and perhaps yourselves as well on a panel with Brookings of all places in the D.C. But my comment to the point of your litigation is where family members or responders have accepted cash payments, have they in any cases have signed away their right to standing to further proceedings?
That's what was running through my mind, Carl. I don't know for sure. I heard in some cases that's happened, but I don't know if it I don't know to the extent it's happened. Okay, so that's a good question. And as we were discussing this, that same question was running through my mind. If they were foreclosed, maybe that's why it's so hard to find plaintiffs, because they've been paid off and told to shut up, basically, right? So,
well, that's my perception was, even from the early on when, yeah, anyone who was a responder, et cetera, was offered, yeah, an amount of money for in order to settle their standing, essentially, so that they, yeah, they couldn't step forward later and keep this going.
Right. I think there was Judge Hellerstein was the other day. Somebody sent me an article where he was, I guess, it's very smug and satisfied that 97 cases, I think, went before them and not one trial. You know, basically everyone took the deal. And that may be the case. Now, we know that Bob McElvain can do that, all right? Bob is free to join. He's joined us in the FBI lawsuit. So Bob McElvain will be back up in this one in New York City, all right? I've already... You know, I know that, but and maybe another person that wanted to be a plaintiff too. So we might have at least two victim family members, but I said John O'Kelly was looking into some others. This ideas with Commissioner Joy are good. You don't need a whole lot. You just need one, right? You need one good plaintiff, and they can't throw a darn thing out. Might be able to dismiss us, but they're not going to dismiss Bob McElvain if he's there. Or they do, they've got to do quite a tap dance to justify that, which I don't think is justifiable. Right? I don't think it's justifiable down in Washington. But what they might say, as I said, the second part, is that they don't have a mandatory duty to do what we believe they should have done, and that's to update Congress, to assess the evidence and report to them. They receive millions of dollars to do it. But you remember that 9/11 Review Commission was, I think, five different things, areas. They were supposed to, like, talk about, you know, the present security and how it's been improved and whether they did improve it. But the last one had to do with this. I think it was point five, had to do with assessing the evidence. And they argued that they did some of that stuff with the Sarasota down in Florida. That they did mention that to Congress and stuff, and we're saying that they didn't do all this other new evidence that we mentioned in those seven counts, and the one again that it's in both of the complaints or both of the petitions or the suits is the ground zero, the World Trade Center explosive evidence for controlled demolitions and bombs.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks, Carl.
And I just had one last thought on that, too. Can some regular citizens just join you in this on the grounds that we've lost our civil liberties because of this?
I don't think they'll allow that. I mean, that's a good one. You think you would have a class action, everybody in the country. You have to show some harm, specific harm. And certainly a parent or a brother or sister could if they lost a relative or family member. That's the kind of harm they're looking at. That's a higher level of harm. Now, the organizations like, Lawyers Committee, I mean, we're dedicated to transparency and accountability in government related to 9/11 crimes, and this is our mission, to educate the public and to get justice as best we can. They may say, well, that's not strong enough standing. You know, who cares about that? So, but the victim's family members, that blood relationship is the most compelling. And if you received an injury from the explosions or the cleanup, all right, so that's compelling. That's the way the courts look at it. So it's not to say we don't have standing. It's that there's stronger standing in the victims family members,
right,
and or injured firemen or first responders.
Okay. All right, thank you. And thank you both, you and Barbara, for all you're doing with the Lawyers Committee. And it's just amazing, and I'm sure we all feel the same way about this. Really appreciate it. And thank you for coming on tonight.
Well, thanks for having us, and thanks for keeping on what you're doing, because you keep the torch burning, okay, by just having those meetings you have, all right?
Oh, yeah, thank you. Okay, great. Well, then we'll move on to our next speaker here. I'm going to unmute Frank Tulupko. Frank is going to talk to us about the latest Malcolm X movie, or maybe the only one. I don't know. Go ahead, Frank.
Oh, hi. Good evening, everybody. Yeah, it's been 55 years. February 21st, is the 55th anniversary of the assassination, and it was an assassination of Malcolm X. And I've been sort of following the story on and off over the years, doing other work and all that, but I certainly was aware of the revelation in 2010 by a Columbia University scholar, Manning Marable, who appeared, I think it was on Amy Goodman, and said that he had done research and discovered that the autobiography of Malcolm X, which was done with Alex Haley, that three chapters were omitted from the book before publication, and the book was published after he died, so there's nothing he could do about it. And much of that contained his political thoughts and his revelations about how he had advanced politically, etc. So that's sort of been sitting out there. But even further than that, there was a news item this past January that Netflix was going to be showing on its its streaming service a new movie that was just made, Who Killed Malcolm X? It is a six-part series. I watched it very intently, and I thought it was an excellent production. The series follows the research and the work of Abdul Rahman Mohammed, an historian and, believe it or not, a tour guide in Washington, D.C. He's an historian, and for years has been investigating the assassination of Mr. Malcolm X. Let me read some of his own words on how he describes himself, what his bona fides are. Mr. Mohammed is an independent scholar based in D.C. He is a historian, journalist, writer, and activist, widely regarded as one of the most respected authorities on the life and legacy of the civil rights era black leader Malcolm X. In fact, he was one of the people that Manning Marable, that I mentioned earlier, used as a source for much of the stuff he put in a Pulitzer Prize-winning book that he published in 2010. He was born, that is, Mr. Mohammed was born as one Kenneth Oliveira in Providence, Rhode Island. He went to Howard University, where he earned a BA degree in philosophy. And Howard Muhammad would first be exposed to the many social, political, and cultural movements for black empowerment, then flourishing during the early 1980s in Washington, D.C. Inspired by the life of Malcolm X, Muhammad accepted Islam, as he is a Muslim, and continued to work tirelessly as an activist and teacher in the role of an imam. He became an imam, attempting to emulate the career of the great Muslim leader by working to reform lives and make positive contribution to the struggle of African-American people in their quest for justice. During his years, he remained committed to research and scholarship and saw himself following in the tradition of the activist scholar, a proud tradition with a long and rich history in the black community. Now, here's another part that, again, is in his words. He states that in the wake of 9/11 attacks, Muhammad began to direct more of his attention to research and writing. Now, I have not spoken with Mr. Mohammed, but it might be interesting to see if that was sort of like some seminal event or something that triggered him to go further with this. At some point, I would like to get in touch with him and see if that's in fact what happened. And his articles appeared in many newspapers and scholarly journals based on his more direct attention to this research. He became an outspoken critic of religious extremism and was called to testify on Capitol Hill to offer his thoughts on how the nation should go about combating it. In 2005, Muhammad struck up a friendship, as I mentioned earlier, with Dr. Marable at Columbia University, and they collaborated. Mr. Marable died just before his book was published also. So he's no longer around and we can, you know, question him. But Muhammad's most important scholarly contribution to date has been the explosive revelation, which is in the film, which was which started in 2010, but is in the film, of the identity of one William Bradley, also known as al-Mustafa Shabazz, the alleged Shatkin assassin, the person that really was responsible for the death and actually was the one that took him out, the alleged Shatkin assassin of Malcolm X, who reportedly fired the first and deadliest shot that took the life of Malcolm X on February 21st, 1965. His face has never been seen on the historical in the historical record in the 45 subsequent years of the killing. Remember, this was written in 2010. So it was only 45 years. Muhammad's identification of Bradley was reported in all the major newspapers in the country, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the New York Star, Ledger, and many others. So this man had been walking around a free man, essentially, and there's very, very, very strong circumstantial evidence that he was the actual assassin. Now, Mr. Muhammad is featured in the documentary that I mentioned earlier entitled Who Killed Malcolm X? That is now on Netflix TV, and I would suggest that everybody, I think it's wonderful theater in a sense that it's presented as a mystery, that he's doing research, and all the trials and tribulations of doing research as a citizen researcher. So I would strongly recommend it. Now, what I noticed in there, in watching the film, that there are many parallels with other assassination events, as well as 9/11. For instance, there are multiple interests involved. Many people wanted Malcolm X dead. Many people wanted the World Trade Center to come down. Involvement of the national and local security state entities, FBI, local police department, Red Squad, the CIA. The cover-up, complicity of the mass media of not presenting the story. That's all presented in the film. Then it becomes the falsifying history and pseudo-deification of those assassinated, such as Che, MLK, and Muhammad X also, etc. I mean, they deified him, Malcolm X, by issuing a stamp to the U.S. Postal Service. Somehow he's become acceptable, and that sort of takes away his revolutionary fervor or identification. And also, as the preventing the access or destruction of documents and physical evidence, that was also true in this particular case. It's all there. Just to name a few of the things that you see in the film is that for those that may not be fully aware of or you know familiar with the events of that day in 1965, the revelations that came out over the years and it's treated in the film is the extensive ring of informers and assets in the closest circles of Malcolm X that were paid for, bought and paid for by the FBI and the local police department. The absence of the New York Police Department on the day of the assassination event. They were constantly following him. There were always dozens of cops wherever he went. All of a sudden, nobody was there that day. In fact, the documents, the dry run of an assassination, the actual week before in the same hall where they created a disturbance, and that's to distract people so somebody could do the shooting, which is exactly the way the assassination occurred a week later. Three men were arrested, one who admitted he was involved as part of the team, but he actually didn't fire the shot that killed him, along with alleged assassins who maintained their innocence. In fact, when the man that was convicted, all three were convicted, was released from jail, he said the other two guys never did anything with me. They never were there. They couldn't possibly. They had alibis. So you had three patsies that were picked up, not immediately, but after that. Again, similar to the JFK assassination and actually probably not MLK assassination. So what I'm suggesting at this point, I have a whole trove of literature that I've been able to ferret out in the last week or two since I've seen the film, which might be of interest to people. On this call, which I don't know is the best way, if I can post it or if we can email me, I can forward some of that stuff, materials to you for your own edification to see how this is, strictly, in other words, another parallel event in the whole litany of assassinations and various bad deeds being done by the security forces in the United States. So I would also like to see if we can perhaps get Mr. Mohammed on the call to answer questions and to see how far he's come and how his relationship to the 9/11 attacks. So I'll leave it at that. You can ask further questions, and we can see how we can perhaps distribute some of this material.
Okay, great. So we're already in Q&A mode, so if you'd like to make a comment or ask Frank a question, it's star 6. And thanks to Frank telling me about this last week ago or so, I've contacted Mr. Mohammed, who made this film, and I'm going to be interviewing him on my radio program next week. And so while I'm talking to him and doing that, I'm going to ask him to come on our call next month. So
And what was his reaction to who you are and why you wanted to interview him?
He just agreed to do it, and we set up a time. He didn't really ask many questions,
he didn't
seem put off about the 9/11 angle of my show or anything. So we're doing it next week. So hopefully,
okay, very good.
I'll let you know how it goes. Yeah. Anybody else have any comments or questions? Star 6. And I think it is really striking that the similarities to all these other events. I think they use the same playbook for sure on all of that. So we have a question.
There's one other point I wanted to make, which I have buried here. Interestingly enough, when the film was announced and came out, the New York Times had an article about it, as well as the Washington Post. And because of this release of this film, the New York District Attorney has agreed to revisit the case to perhaps reopen it based on the new evidence that has come out, which I think is very interesting. It's been 55 years. A lot of people are dead. They're not going to face justice or whatever. But it's interesting that at some point the evidence becomes so overwhelming about something that was bad that they're forced to do something, I guess, if only to save face as law enforcement officials. So I think that's an interesting thing to perhaps – I don't know that we should wait 55 years for 9/11 truth to come out. But the point is that I guess when presented with overwhelming evidence, they tend to bend. We'll see how that works out. They said they're visiting to look at it. They want to reopen the case. There were attempts to reopen the case by William Kunstler at the turn of the century, like it was 20 years ago. But that was thrown out of court. So there have been attempts to reopen the case. But now, 20 years later, I guess they feel they have to do something.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and Frank, we do have one question here from Barry. Barry, go ahead.
Yeah, it's Barry Zwicker here. And there was a documentary made in the 1990s called Seven Songs for Malcolm X. It's very rarely been seen. I saw it about 3 or 4 weeks ago at the Bloor Hot Dog Cinema in Toronto. And in that film, it states that about 1 week before he was assassinated, Malcolm X had reached an agreement with Martin Luther King that the two of them would get together and work jointly. I wonder if that has come up in the new documentary or if you've heard that anywhere else. It is in that documentary, Seven Songs for Malcolm X.
I don't recall at this moment because there's so much information in the film if that actually came up. But in all the documents that I have collected over the last week or so, it is mentioned. It is mentioned in some of the documents. I can't quote it right now, but I'll post all of the documents that I have, and it's in there. I do recall reading about that. There's no question that they were coming to some sort of agreement. Malcolm X was becoming more, inclusive in the fight for economic justice as well as racial justice, as well as Martin Luther King saying, the ballot ballot or the bullet, coming more to the bullet thing, not necessarily that he was going to have street demonstrations, et cetera, but he knew that that would be something more, civil disobedience or whatever, to make their point.
Yeah. Thank you.
So with Seven Songs for Malcolm X, I'm going to look that up.
Right.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Frank, for presenting on that and for getting me into it, because I'm looking forward to that interview with him.
So what are you suggesting I do with this material? I can certainly give you all the citations before your interview, but if anybody else is interested, what's the best way that I can forward this information that anybody's interested?
If you want to send it to Craig and I, and we'll put it in the minutes, and then or you can send an email to the group, or both.
Okay. I'll send it to you and Craig. You do it the way you think is best.
Okay. Okay, sounds good.
All right.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, and last but not least, Gerald, let me unmute you. Okay, and thank you for your patience, Gerald. And you're going to be speaking to us about Bill Binney?
Correct. And actually, I have to thank David Maiswinkle for already covering what I was going to say about the event. Which I assume David and others there are already aware of. It's at Symphony Space this coming Saturday, February 29th, 5 to 8 p.m. And the title is A Conversation with Bill Binney, Rescuing the Republic from the Surveillance State. And certainly everything that Jonathan presented, that Barbara and David presented, and that our friend here presented on Malcolm X, Frank Tolopko, is really, I guess you could say, think of it from this conceptual standpoint, that the criminals from what we in the LaRouche movement call the permanent bureaucracy of the Department of Justice, which we always said operated like a bunch of hitmen, contract assassins. Someone would walk into the DOJ and flash their credentials or give the right sign, and this permanent bureaucracy in the DOJ would know, okay, that group of people or this guy, we're going to get them. We're going to get them. And our point on this 25 years ago was, if you don't take out this permanent bureaucracy of the permanent Department of Injustice, then no one is safe. No one. No person, no president, no governor, no civil rights leader, no one is safe until this permanent bureaucracy is uprooted, prosecuted, jailed, etc. So what I think is unique in this case with Bill Binney is we have the criminals caught at the scene of the crime. That is, we're not talking about something that happened X amount of years ago, which I certainly appreciate everything Frank said and that Barbara and David said and that Jonathan said. You know, going back more than 25 years, obviously JFK, but also Eleanor Roosevelt was attacked by the FBI, et cetera, et cetera. So this actually goes back quite a distance with J. Edgar Hoover, Palmer, et cetera, et cetera. But what we have here in the case of Binney is we're catching the criminals right in the scene of the crime, in the action. And so here's what I'm talking about. For people who don't know, Binney, as was discussed by James Bamford, the foremost authority on the NSA, Binney had the rank of equivalent of general at the NSA. He was in charge of a 6,000-strong research center called Signals Intelligence Automation Research Center. And what Binney did with 9/11, as also David said, with the thin thread, and I believe Kirk Wiebe, also from the thin thread of NSA, will be there with Bill on Saturday, and others will be there, is that they had the guts to blow the whistle, and as a result of them resigning and saying 9/11 could have been prevented and that was sabotaged, and their refusal to give in, just like everyone on this call, we refuse to give in to bullshit. Binny has maintained that dedication, and so what we're talking about here, which he'll be talking about Saturday night, is he had a meeting with Mike Pompeo. Binny was contacted by President Trump and was told to get a hold of Pompeo. A meeting was held October 24, 2017 with Mike Pompeo, then head of the CIA, now Secretary of State. So Binney's discussion with Pompeo, without going into details, because this is a short five-minute rundown, Pompeo never said a word to Trump about what Binney and briefed Pompeo and two other people from the CIA who were there, who had expressed at the meeting with Binney that they actually took it seriously. Trump had ordered the meeting. Now, we know Trump has been briefed on this by other people, but the question is, what the hell is Pompeo doing? Is he another, who's that guy with the mustache who got kicked out of the NSA? Bolton. Is he another Bolton? Whereas Trump is talking about good relations with Russia and China, Pompeo is talking about bad relations with Russia and China, blah, blah, blah. So Binny will be discussing this meeting with Pompeo and the follow-up. Unbeknownst to many of you, Binny is also involved in the Roger Stone case. Binny is also involved in the General Flynn case. And I don't have time to go into it, but let's just say all of that will be brought out. So the reason I'm urging people who are in the New York area or environs to get to the meeting Saturday is we're talking about current history. We're talking about changing the course of future history, and we're talking about giving meaning to the people like yourselves who haven't let the lies and the murders and the assassinations that have destroyed the fabric of this country from actually winning out. And so last point is, as of about 24 hours ago, we have arranged for Binny's conversation, Rescuing the Republic from the Surveillance State, to be live streamed so you could be anywhere in the country and be able to watch it. So that's my 5 minutes. It should be, it's a great to expose the injustices of the past. It's even greater to actually catch the criminals in the act and change the course of history. And I would say with the coronavirus, with the war danger, and also it looks like certain people are trying to use the coronavirus to run a panic and create a global financial collapse. Oh my God, financial collapse. So therefore, the importance of U.S., Russia, China, India, four powers, which already Putin is talking about having a summit meeting of five powers. Lavrov, foreign minister, reiterated this at the meeting in Geneva today. So this is Russia, China, and France have already agreed to it. And what Lavrov reported today is that the U.S. and Britain also have had positive response. So we could have a meeting that could end the wars, end the abuses. And I know everyone goes, oh, you can't do that. I say bullshit. We can do anything we want to do and we decide to do, and that includes getting the truth of 9/11 out and the truth of Malcolm X assassination out and the truth of Kennedy assassination out. All of it is possible if you dare to think, rather than just being, couch potatoes and commentator, what they call backseat drivers and Monday morning quarterbacks and all that kind of stuff. So that's my point. People should
All right.
get with the present fight. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Gerald, very much. And we have a question here from Barbara Honegger. Barbara, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Barb. Could you very slowly and clearly let us know where we can watch the live stream of the Vinny event and the date and time again, East Coast time?
Yeah, the East Coast time, Barbara, is 5 o'clock. I'm on the Pacific time zone like you, so it's 2 o'clock our time. We'll be showing it live at the LaRouche Pack office. We're out by Hegenberger Road, you know, in the Oakland area. And we'll be showing it live, but I will have the link, and I can send it to you or send it to the to Cheryl and
well,
Funky.
Well, everybody on the call needs the link, but sometimes the minutes take a long time to go. What is the date of this again?
Saturday, February 29th. This coming Saturday.
Okay. Yep. Do you
is there
know
a
the
website,
link?
Gerald?
Can you just tell us the link right now?
You know, I don't have it in front of me, actually. Dennis Speed has your email, I assume. I could get it from him, or you can give it to me, and I'll email it to you or anyone else
right,
who's interested.
We'd all like to have this link as soon as possible.
Okay. All right. Well, tell me how to send it. Now, as soon as I get it, I just don't have it in front of me.
Is there a website that would be contain this information?
You know, good question. I honestly can't answer.
Just email us and we'll send it out to everyone. Yeah.
That's perfect.
Just email Cheryl and she'll get it to all of us.
Yeah. Cheryl, you got it. As soon as I get it, I'll get it, but this was just arranged. And that's when I contacted you when I realized people from all over might want to see it. And then when I heard David speaking, I realized people in the New York area knew already, but people from around the horn might be interested. So, yes, I will email it to you, and I thank Barbara for bringing that up because I forgot.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much, Cheryl, for bringing it to our attention. And if anyone else have a comment or a question for Gerald, it would be star 6. And I don't see anyone else there, so let's move on then to any announcements, anything anyone want to share, other issues want to bring up? Well, if anyone thinks of something while you're thinking for a moment, I do want to recommend people read this book that Frank Tilepko actually informed me about, and I started reading it. It's called The Gold Warriors by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave. And it's really an amazing book, and it supposedly is, I haven't finished it, I've just started it, but it supposedly will help explain the bonds that were taken out and coming due on September 12th, 2001. So, but it's a great read, and it's amazing, so I would highly recommend it. And I also understand that the two authors are actually in hiding because of writing this book, so fascinating book. Anyway, and again, it's called The Gold Warriors by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave. Anybody else have announcements? All right, well, if not, then thank you all for joining the call tonight. Next month we do have, again, we're going to try and get Abdur-Rahman Mohammed to speak about the Malcolm X film that he created, and Craig will be presenting on Shanksville. So that's what we have so far for next month. So thank you all for joining us. Have a good month. See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.